Okay, capitalism and unhealthy option is the title of the talk. Thank you all for coming. Nice to see you here. We're in the middle of a recession. Okay, I don't think I actually need to provide evidence or anything for that. I think we can assume that everyone knows that fact. But what does this actually mean? I mean, well, one of the things it means that for working people, lives in general are much harder than they have been up until a few years ago. And in many ways, especially in terms of our relationships with the state and with the institutions of capitalism, life has become somewhat more demeaning for a lot of us as well. But not for all, though. I mean, I'm sure you know, as I know, there are people, working people, friends, who've not really been directly affected by it. And there are, I actually know some people are doing better now than they were 5 years ago financially. But that, in a way, that's only to be expected. Depressions are partial and they're unpredictable, and that's just what we would expect from a system like capitalism, which is, in effect, an anarchic way of organising our economic affairs. Of course, even those people who are not directly affected, they're going to be affected indirectly. There's the increased anxiety. Everyone knows people, friends, family, who have been affected by it. So it's not a good time. And of course, on top of that, the government, this coalition government, is currently trying to shift the cost of the recession onto the working class. So through cutting services, through reducing incomes in various ways, etc. So since 2008, we've been in a situation where markets are completely out of sync. The process of buying and selling has slowed down considerably. What's actually happened fundamentally is that the opportunity for profit has fallen, and those who own capital have basically gone on strike. They're no longer investing the money that they're actually coming in from the profits of previous production. There are various figures around. One that I've actually seen is that currently businesses are only investing 65% of their retained profits. The rest is being hoarded, or liquidity preference is the Keynesian term that's bandied around these days. So what does the future look like? Well, yesterday we were informed that we are now back in recession in the UK. But only the week before that, The Economist had seen the first green shoots of recovery. But this is a situation that we are fairly familiar with, because economists are often struggling to identify what the future holds for us. Basically, nobody knows. But if the economist meant anything at all, by the first green shoots, it certainly didn't mean that there are going to be more jobs available, that our terms and conditions are going to improve, that state services are going to improve support for those who are least able. What it does mean, or what it did mean, is that they saw a slight improvement, a slight increase in the value of stocks and bonds, which means that if you do own capital, well, that's good news. Well, yeah, moderately good news. And if not, well, The Economist wasn't even going there. Right, well, the thing about economic depressions is that they tend to focus the minds of people like you and I on our security, financial security, our future security, the security of our children, on our income, and on our living standards. And we tend also to look for people to blame. And of course, at the moment, everybody is blaming the bankers. Even the media, with some reservations, are blaming the bankers. Despite the simple recurring fact that since 1840, depressions, busts, just like booms, are part of a recurring cycle of capitalism. You can blame individuals, but what we've actually got is a systemic problem. It's a problem within the system itself. Boom follows bust, bust follows boom. Some of the busts are worse than others, but they occur regularly and have occurred regularly here and right across the capitalist world, ever since capitalism first coalesced into a system in 1840. So it's been ongoing like that. And one of the things that sorry, I'm losing my place. One of the things is about capitalism, though, is that it's a very robust system. And if we're in a depression now, at some point in the future, it will haul itself out of it. Now, it may be a couple of years' time, it may be 5 years' time, 10, maybe even 20 years. I mean, there have been depressions as long as that, in the 1880s, for example. But sooner or later, it's going to haul itself out, and people are going to start thinking, maybe the good times are coming a little bit more again. And we'll be in a situation where those who own capital will be able to invest it in a way which will enable them to use our labour to squeeze a profit out of us. So that will give us more bargaining power, wages will rise, and again, there's the possibility of good times. But what I want to propose to you is that's very short-term thinking, because what it actually means is that we forget, in our enthusiasm for an improvement in our lives, a moderate improvement in our current lives, what we forget is that capitalism has never been able to solve the problem of poverty. It's never been able to provide a decent, fulfilling life for people. It's never been able to do any of these things. And all we can look forward to is just the same old cycle round and round again. Here's a quote from a Radio 4 programme broadcast called Capitalism on Trial, took place last year. Much of what has happened on Wall Street and the City of London in recent years has taken place under the banner of capitalism and free markets. But the reality is that it often hasn't lived up to these ideals and principles at all. Now, what the speaker here is suggesting is that capitalism is a bundle of ideals and principles. And what I want to suggest to you is that it's actually nothing of the kind. It's a very clear material system which we've evolved for ourselves. Now, when human beings create, devise a piece of technology, a new computer, a new car, whatever it is, we like to furnish it with a set of buttons and levers because we like to be able to control what we've produced. Now, the capitalist system is just as much a product of human endeavour as a car or an iPod or a PC. But we didn't plan it. It evolved out of our scattered actions, or particularly it evolved out of the actions of a certain group of people who saw a way of making money by employing labour. But it wasn't until the end of the 18th century that thinkers like Adam Smith and other philosophers and economists started to wonder how this thing that they'd created, how it actually worked. And more specifically, and especially among later economists, they wanted to know how they could control it. Well, I would just suggest to you that given all the evidence of the last 150 years, despite all their endeavours, they haven't actually been very successful in controlling it. There's always somebody to blame. It's always the same as we tend to think about, sort of blaming it on the bankers. There is always somebody to blame for something that's gone wrong. But go wrong it does, and repeatedly it does here and right the way across the capitalist world. Right, what I want to do in this talk in particular is, obviously, I want to give you a socialist perspective. And the socialist perspective is that there is actually, frankly, nothing that we can do to actually change the system, to make it work in the way that we want it, except by abolishing it. It's the only action we can take which will actually fundamentally change the way in which the world is organised. What you and I might want to do is to satisfy our needs as human beings. Yeah? And that's what we would want a social system that we've kind of organised for ourselves to give for us. Well, I have to tell you that capitalism was never in the first place created in order to meet the needs of human beings. It was created in the first place to meet the needs of a small section of society who, as I said, had got the idea and had understood that by employing the labour of others, they could make money, they could make a profit. So it's no surprise, or it should come as no surprise to us, when capitalism does not meet human needs, because it was never designed to do so in the first place. And this is true of every aspect of capitalism's functioning. So I can't, in what is beginning to sound like it's going to be quite a long talk, what I can't do today is to provide you with a global understanding of how that might happen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on one small area of our social experience and look at the way in which capitalism tries to deal with that. Okay. And for this meeting, I've actually chosen the area of health. And because health is, in capitalism, everything is a commodity. If it's not a commodity now, it soon will be, because somebody will find some way to commodify it. So health, like everything else in capitalism, has to be treated like a commodity, which can be bought and sold. And so therefore I want to look at, and because commodities are produced by large organisations, businesses, firms, industries, I want to look at two particular industries which relate to our health under capitalism. And on the face of it, these are industries that will make two quite different moral claims, or moral claims upon us. And one of those industries is the pharmaceutical industry, and the other industry is the tobacco industry. Now, if you look at the products of these industries, they might seem to be coming from very different directions. One is, if you believe their publicity, their marketing, one is focused on maintaining and pursuing human health, and the other, it's a leisure activity, but one which we now know quite clearly damages human health. So, in fact, these might seem to be quite distinct industries. However, in the context of capitalism, they pursue one aim, and their attitudes and approaches to what they produce are identical, and the way in which they relate to the state and to other people is identical. And that's what I want to kind of pursue in this talk. Within our system, though, of course, you don't categorise or you don't understand particular industries by what they say. It's what they do. And that's what I want to look at. And I'm going to be talking about that in some detail. But first of all, I want to just give you a very brief whistle tour summary of health, the health of, particularly the health of the working class in Britain from the beginning of the 19th century, just to put this in context. Back in about 1817, human health among the working class was not good. And from about 1817, it began to plummet. That was nothing new about that. In any kind of class society, you often find a distinction between the health of a ruling class and other classes in society. You only have to go back to, say, 1348, to the Black Death. Until very recently, historians have been very blithely saying, well, it affected everyone equally. In fact, we now know through some very precise local studies which have been gathered together that it didn't do that at all. In fact, if you were a peasant or a member of the minor clergy in 1348, 1349, you were much, much more likely to die than if you were a merchant, an aristocrat, or a bishop, a member of the church. The average age, does anybody know the average age of the life expectancy at birth of somebody, say, in the Middle Ages, 14th century? Anyone?
It was something in their 40s.
17. It was 17. The average life expectancy at birth in the Middle Ages was 17. As it was in the factories in Manchester and London, in the 1820s. If you were a member of a working class, the average life expectancy was 17. I've got a quote from Marx here. "It's precisely among the workers in large-scale industry that we meet with the shortest life expectancy. Dr. Lee, Medical Officer of Health for Manchester, stated that the average age of death of the Manchester upper middle class was 38 years, while the average age of death of the labouring class was 17, no change since the Middle Ages. While at Liverpool, these figures were presented as 35 against 15. It does appear that the well-to-do classes had a lease of life which was more than double the value of that which fell to the lot of the less favoured citizens. Now, what happened in the early 19th century was that it was in the early stages of industrialisation, it was in the early stages of capitalism as a system where it was really beginning to come together. And those people who owned sufficient capital had invested heavily in lots of really expensive machinery. It was just coming off out of the factories in the first time. And they needed to get the most out of it quickly. And they needed no more than unskilled labour. They had no investment in the people who worked in their factories. They just needed unskilled labour. So they exploited them to the hilt. And that was why we got this huge lack of health within the factories. I don't want to go into it here now, but the history of factory workers in the early 19th century is fascinating if you have the stomach to actually read it. From the 1870s, this began to improve, and the mortality rate fell. And there were a number of reasons for this. It had, first of all, nothing to do with medicine. The focus on anatomy within the medical schools had not actually brought many changes or many improvements in medicine. It wasn't until they started focusing on the chemistry of the body later in the 19th century, early 20th century in physiology that it actually brought any significant benefits. What had happened is the Public Health Acts. And the Public Health Acts had been introduced from 1848. Now, historians go into all kinds of reasons for that. They say it was self-protection on the part of the middle class because diseases will affect the middle class just as much as affect the working class. Well, we've seen that's not actually quite true. It was more to do with the militancy, additional militancy of the working class at that time, also to do with their increasing income as the social product increased. And there were structural changes. This was the most important thing. There were structural changes. There was a technological innovation, an intensification of the labour process. And in order to do that, you needed more educated workers. You needed people who knew what they were doing, not people who were just exhausted by day after day working these incredible machines. You needed people who were able to think. And when you do that, you start to have to think about the health of your workforce more effectively, because your workforce are a resource. Like any other things, like raw materials, like machines in your factory, your working people are a resource, so you have to start thinking about them. And then in 1870, because you needed a more educated workforce, the Foster Education Act came in so that all working children had to go to school to be educated. Now, as soon as you do that, you're drawing on taxpayers' money. And taxpayers' money, the burden of tax, we would say in the Socialist Party, always falls upon the capitalist class. But certainly at this period, you can see very much it fell on the capitalist class. And if you're going to invest in something, you want to get the best out of it. So if you're investing in a worker's education, you don't want them to die at 15-20, because you want them to work on and produce as much surplus value, as much profit for you as you possibly can. So fundamentally, capitalism sees human beings in terms of labour, in terms of a resource. And it sees its values, unlike human values, and this is the contrast I want to keep in your head. Human values, we have all kinds of values as human beings, don't we? We value all sorts of things. We value time with our family, we value leisure, we value honesty, we value trust, we value all kinds of things. And these things are not quantifiable, okay? They're not quantifiable. You can't reduce them to a number, to a mathematical formula. Despite the fact that the early Victorian economists tried to do that, they invented a unit called the util, and you could assess anything that they believed in human behaviour and human happiness in terms of its utility, in terms of this unit of the util. But of course, they soon had to abandon that. So unlike human values, the values of capitalism are quantifiable. You reduce everything to a number. Everything has to be measured in dollars, pounds, yen, rubles, whatever. You have to reduce it down to this quantifiable amount. And you find in practice that that's what happens over and over and again, that when a business is actually assessing its workforce, the cost of its workforce, etc., it reduces in some way, it asks the question, what is the value of a human being in money terms? And the most elaborate example of that I've ever come across took place during the Reagan administration in America. And they actually decided, after extensive research, that the average worker was worth $2 million. Okay, that was the value of a worker's life, $2 million. Right? And one thing that you will notice on any kind of analysis like that is that women are always less valuable than men. Okay? So that is the way in which that's the way in which capitalist logic, capitalist rationality works, reduces everything down to a figure. There are other. It just doesn't matter. There's a cost-benefit analysis to everything. I remember the very first time I came across this. It was a government. The government was thinking about introducing a law which would make it necessary to put tailboards on lorries because small cars were driving under them and people were getting decapitated if they had to brake quickly. And basically, it was down to a cost-benefit analysis. What costed most? The cost to the firm of putting the tailboards on the lorries or the cost of cleaning up the mess afterwards? Everything is reduced in capitalist rationality down to this simple equation of money. Everything. No, you will find it everywhere. There's no exceptions. You find it everywhere. Right, so in the 1850s, this new health program was introduced by people like Edwin Chadwick, Nassau Senior, Jeremy Bentham, the whole sort of social reformers of that period. And even then they came up against conflict with workers, with businesses, individual businesses. The pig farmers didn't like it because they liked to collect the offal, because they could actually then go and take it off to their pigs. And there was an awful lot of offal lying around in Victorian streets because cows were often slaughtered outside butcher shops and the guts were just sort of left on the ground. The dung collectors didn't like it because the tanners, right up until the 1950s and 60s, tanners used to use dung in order to process leather. The people who collected urine didn't like it because it was actually used as a bleaching agent. So the government had an awful lot of trouble getting through its bill to improve the health of the working class. What I want you to appreciate what's going on there is that the government is acting on behalf of the capitalist class as a whole. It wants to introduce reforms which will benefit the capitalist class as a whole. Now, that doesn't actually work with individuals. There's a conflict sometimes between what individual firms need and what the capitalist class as a whole needs. And that's one of the fundamental contradictions that Marx actually discovered within capitalism. That there is it's only one of many ways in which the system is constantly at odds with itself and is actually strangling itself half the time because of these contradictions. Okay, so we come on to the 20th century. Increasingly, the state intervenes on behalf of the owners of capital as a whole and again meets conflict from individual businesses, but nevertheless pursues ahead right up until the time of the Beveridge Report and the introduction of the National Health Service. Again, if you read the parliamentary debates about it, if you read the reports that were actually produced on it, it was all about saving money for the capitalist class. It was all about preventing revolution because it was thought that after the war, I think it was Quentin Hogg who said in the House of Commons, if we don't give them reform, they'll give us revolution. And it was a very mean-minded programme. If you actually look at it, it was offering very little. In fact, the Socialist Party at the time wrote a pamphlet which complained that it was nothing to do with social welfare because A, it wasn't social because it was aimed firmly at the working class, not society as a whole, and B, it wasn't really welfare because it was actually so mean-minded. They called it a cheese-paring administration. But anyway, that's the background. In capitalism, health is a commodity and has to be seen as such. Now, from the 1950s onwards, there was a great revolution, technological revolution, in pharmacy and pharmaceuticals. So I'm going to move on now to the pharmaceutical industry. We expect drugs to be well-tested, safe, and effective. Well, our expectations are not always met. This is Ben Goldacre in his book, Bad Science. Whatever our political leanings, everyone is basically a socialist when it comes to healthcare. He means by socialist something slightly different to we would, but we know what he means. We all feel nervous about profit taking away any role in the caring professions, but that feeling has nowhere to go. And that's the point in capitalism, that feeling has nowhere to go, because in capitalism, healthcare is a matter of profit. And like any business, the pharmaceutical industry applies the rationality of capitalism, not the rationality of the rest of humanity or of society. Now, we know a lot about the pharmaceutical industry. The media deals with it from time to time, not very often. A lot of it doesn't get reported, what's going on, but it deals with it from time to time. We all know about the refusal of the pharmaceutical industry to provide cheap drugs for AIDS victims in Africa on the grounds that Africans can't pay for it because they need to maintain prices. They claim that they need the profits in order to pursue further research and development. Now, I'll go into this in a bit more detail in a minute, but I will just point out to you that research and development is actually a very small part of the budget of pharmaceutical companies. Despite the huge costs of new drugs, I think it's about 14%. That compares with 31%, which they spend on marketing. Okay. So that's not really a very good argument, but we'll come back to that. It's also fairly well known that they brought their big guns to bear on India when the Indian government was allowing the production of cheap drugs off patent, and they went in very heavily there, and the Indian government had to modify its legislation. It didn't actually, the drug companies didn't manage to get rid of it, and in fact, right as we're here now, there is a court case going on in India to deal with another challenge to the Indian right to manufacture cheap drugs, which are elsewhere on patent around the world. And the pharmaceutical companies are very, very eagle-eyed. They're watching this very, very carefully. Now, all pharmaceutical research involves risk. Now, we have to accept that. I mean, some of you might remember TGN 1412 in 2006. A group of young men on a trial were seriously injured as a result of the drugs that were being tested. We have to accept that if we're going to test drugs in society anyhow, there are risks. There are some risks. However, most of the risks involved in the pharmaceutical industry actually come from the need of the companies to pursue profit. And I'll hope to demonstrate that to you in a little while. Ben Goldacre, Bad Science again. Big Pharma, which is a collective name for the drug companies, Pharma is one of their trade organisations in America. Big Pharma is evil. I would agree with this premise, he says. And I think socialists with reservations can agree with it as well, although we wouldn't put it in those terms. We'd frame it in terms of the quantitative rationality of capitalism, the need to reduce everything to a figure, the need to produce a profit, the need to be profitable in a way that allows you to be competitive with your competition. So Big Pharma are simply following the dictates of the system. Of course, the state may intervene to protect the interests of the capitalist class as a whole, and we've seen it doing that recently. Because, of course, it has to fund the National Health Service on behalf of the entire capitalist class. And therefore, the interests of the pharmaceutical, it has to weigh up the particular interests of the pharmaceutical industries against the general interest of capitalism across the board, the national capital. The National Institute of Clinical Excellence produces a formulary of drugs which the NHS can use. And that, in fact, is just obviously based on a simple, straightforward cost calculation. The UK pharmaceutical industry is very important in this country. It's the third most important industry that's actually left. after finance, which comes first, and tourism, which comes second. It's worth £7 billion a year to the UK, and it's worth £150 billion a year globally. Let's have a look at some of the market pressures that are on the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, well, first of all, there's research and development. This costs money, and a great deal of money. So it's under pressure to keep those costs down. Initially, they in America, a lot of this was done in medical schools. But the problem with medical schools, the damn problem with medical schools, is they do things thoroughly to make sure they don't make mistakes. And if they do that, it takes them time and labour and resources, which costs money. So that wasn't really very convenient. There had been a number of American scandals, particularly in America, of drug companies, drug tests going wrong. So the American population were not that keen to sort of volunteer either. Universities stepped in for a while, but again, I mean, the university is perfect. They have the kudos, they have the money, they have the research, they have the knowledge, they have everything. But again, they were too damn expensive. So what's happened in America and Britain and in the West now is that we get the development of associated biotech companies offering to do this research on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry. And they are sold exclusive contracts. Yeah. So it's, you know, money starting to come into there very, very strongly. The second constraint, again, we'll talk about that in a minute. The second market constraint is demand. Now, this is a big one, because if the pharmaceutical companies are going to survive in a capitalist market, they have to make money. So what are they going to make money on? Or rather, let's have a look at what they can't make money on. Lots of very acute illnesses, which we all suffer all the time. Yeah, cold. Why has there never been a cure for the common cold? You know, we say, you know, it's like we've never... Well, why would the pharmaceutical industry want to research a cure for the common cold? The reason is, it's very widespread. We all get it. But after a couple of Lemsips, it's gone. Yeah, so there is no long-term... We're not going to end up with long-term prescriptions for drugs. So they're not going to make a lot of money out of it. So they're certainly not going to put any major research effort into it. So they're not going to look at simple, acute, short-term illness. Then there's long-lasting illnesses. On contrary, some illnesses go on for a lifetime, for years and years and years and years. But of these, many have very few sufferers. Some are rare, like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Yeah, I think there is one person per million per year who suffers from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. In this country, it would be, say, 60 people. So again, you know, there's a lifetime prescription possibility there for the drug companies, but not a great deal of demand. So there's no cure because there is no research, because there is no money. There is no profit to be made. And then there's relatively common fatal diseases. Take, for example, motor neurone disease. And you get 1 to 5 in every 10,000. That's quite a lot of people, actually, when you think about it. So there's a potential market there, or is there? The problem is, if you get motor neurone disease, most forms, many different forms, but ALS, the most common form of motor neurone disease, from the time the disease is identified to the time you, let's be frank, you die, is about 18 months. Okay, it's relatively short term. So again, not a lot, not a very big market because of the shortness of the actual illness. So there's no cure for motor neurone disease, not much research either. Let's have a look, where have we got to? And then there's very many, there are very common diseases which have many people who suffer from them over long periods. And this is looking more promising from the pharmaceutical company's point of view. However, a lot of people suffering from these diseases live in places like Africa or South America, who are relatively poor and can't afford the drugs. No research because of no profit. I mean, I've got a couple of examples here, like Chagas disease in Central South America. It's a parasitic disease. You get about 10 million sufferers, awful lot of people suffering. It actually just simply corrodes away at your gastrointestinal tract. It's a degenerative disease. But, you know, it's like nobody's going to pay for expensive medication for them. No research. And then there's trypanosomiasis, which is sleeping sickness. This is in Africa. It's fundamentally based. 300,000 people die every year from this. Same problem. Absolutely same problem. Yeah? Companies can't make any money out of it, so they don't research. This is an example, I think, as I tried to say early on, of how capitalism actually endangers your health. It endangers your health because the potentiality of the technology that we actually now possess to find cures for these diseases cannot be used under the capitalist mode of production. It cannot actually be used. There's another problem. There's, for example, in many drugs, you can't patent. And there's a wonderful example of this. Many, countless women over the last century have died from preeclampsia in childbirth, a form of hypertension, a group of other symptoms as well. Round about, I think it was around about 1906, someone discovered that magnesium sulfate, a very simple, ordinary, cheap, widely available substance, could actually, was very effective in treating preeclampsia. It never caught on because the drug companies couldn't patent it. They couldn't make any money out of it. They couldn't patent it. So they put their research into very expensive antispasmodics instead. And so for many years in the West, women with preeclampsia were treated with these expensive antispasmodics. Women in South America and elsewhere, because the idea never caught on, countless women died who could have been saved simply as a result of the use of magnesium sulfate. Okay, and nowadays, actually, they've recently discovered that the simple amino acid arginine plus a few antioxidants will actually do the same job. Very, very cheap. You can buy them off the shelves anywhere. Okay, so let's give the companies their due. It costs about £500 million to bring a new drug to market these days. And they don't want dodos. You know, they don't want to start researching something, spend £300 million and find it's going nowhere. Yeah? And that sometimes happens. Yeah? So, you know, they're up against it. You know, they themselves are constrained by the conditions of capitalism. They're not just evil people. I mean, some of them may be. But on the whole, they are constrained by the conditions, the economic conditions under which they work. So what's the result of this? They have a very strong incentive to massage the facts. And we know they do this, and we know they do it regularly. So they produce drugs which are not that safe, or which don't do what they claim to do, because the effects have been massaged. And I'll give you a couple of examples in a minute. But I've dug up here a few examples. I won't, there's dozens of them, but a few examples of the way in which drug companies can do this. Here's one. You ignore the protocol entirely. You assume that any correlation proves causation. Fundamental error in science. You report as positives any relationship with anything at all. If you make a sufficient number of measurements, you're bound to hit some positives by sheer luck. Play with the baseline. Sometimes when you start a trial, quite by chance, the treatment group, those who are going to get the research drug, is already doing better than the placebo group. If so, ignore the fact in your report. If, on the other hand, they're doing worse, adjust your baseline accordingly for your analysis. Ignore dropouts. Dropouts are statistically much more likely to have done badly in the trial and have had much worse side effects. Ignore them. They will only make your drug look bad. Do not follow them up. Do not include them in your final analysis. Clean up the data. Look at your graphs. There will always be some anomalous individual results which lie outside the normal range of results. If they're making your drug look bad, delete them. If they're making it look good, leave them in, no matter how spurious they are. Torture the data. If your results are bad, check out if there were subgroups who behaved differently. You might find that your drug works well in Chinese women between 50 and 61. Go for it. I mean, there's a whole list of things here. I'm not going to read them all out. But there are many, many ways in which it's known that drug companies massage their facts because they don't want dodos. They don't want to spend £300 million on a new drug and then find that it's going nowhere. Now, one particular case study of this are the SSRIs. I don't know if any of you knows about the SSRIs. It's, they have been in the news from time to time. SSRI stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor. In 1965, Joseph Schildkraut, who was an American psychiatrist, produced a paper in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and he proposed that serious psychiatric illnesses were the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain. In particular, he was focusing on what are known as neurotransmitters. Now, though I don't want to go into the physiology of this very much, but very briefly, in the brain, in your brain, you have 100 billion neurons. Okay? These are cells which connect to other neurons and pass messages along their length, mostly in the form of an electric current which travels down the outside of the neuron. You have 100 billion of these. Each neuron then connects with between 1,000 and 10,000 other neurons to pass those messages on further. So it's a chain of neurons. And when two neurons meet, in the vast majority of cases, they pass the message on not through an electric current, but chemically. Where they come together, they exist about 20 nanometers apart, a little gap of 20 nanometers. A nanometer is 1 billionth of a meter. So there's this tiny gap between the neurons. And to pass the message on, the presynaptic neuron, the neuron before the synapse, which is this little gap, the presynaptic neuron secretes a chemical called a neurotransmitter. It passes over the gap, latches onto receptors on the postsynaptic neuron, and the postsynaptic neuron then responds accordingly, according to what kind of neuron it is. Now, there's about 100, well, in fact, no, there's more, there's several hundred of these neurotransmitters, these chemicals that jump the gap. But five or six really very important ones. And perhaps the most important one of all is serotonin. And serotonin is a very ancient chemical. It's found, it's a neurotransmitter found in even the most primitive of nervous systems. So it's been with us a long time, and that means it's responsible for some of our most fundamental life-preserving functions, pathways in the brain. It's really very important. And what Schildkraut proposed was that if you're depressed, and there was kind of some little research that suggested this might be the case, if you're depressed, there's not enough serotonin being secreted to stimulate the nerves on the other side of the synapse, the postsynaptic neurons. Okay. So he suggested what you need to do is you need to do something to prevent, to actually stimulate the serotonin. Now, you can't put stuff in, but there's a very interesting little mechanism in the brain. Once a nerve has secreted its, once a neuron has secreted its serotonin, once it's attached onto the receptors and stimulated the further nerve, you have to get rid of it, or else the nerve on the other side will just keep firing. And the body, the brain, does this in two ways. One way, it simply reabsorbs the serotonin back into the initial neuron. And the second way, it has some little enzymes which go around and gobble it all up and take it away and change it into another chemical. So instead of trying to put more serotonin into the system, you can prevent it being reabsorbed. And that's what an SSRI does, in theory. It reabsorbs the serotonin. It prevents the serotonin being reabsorbed and theoretically increases the charge so that depressed people get more serotonin in their brain, stop being depressed. Very simple idea. And if you think about it, it's a bit silly, really. You have this thing, this brain, this human brain, this extraordinary human brain. It weighs about 3 pounds in your hand like that. You have to have two hands. It's quite big. 100 billion neurons, in fact, 600 billion ancillary cells as well. You know, 150 trillion synaptic things, serotonin chemical. Well, anyway, the research was flawed. It's known to be flawed. There's several pieces of research, and the actual results were good, but the interpretation was flawed. In Stockholm, in America, there were particular studies, and it was all flawed. It's all known. In fact, there's a guy called David Healy. He's a really interesting Irish psychiatrist. In 2005, and I'm not going to spare your sensitivities, he said the serotonin theory of depression is comparable to the masturbatory theory of psychiatry, of insanity. Well, actually, a psychiatrist as well. That might have been the end of the story, except it wasn't. Because in 1988, Eli Lilly, which is a drug company in America, produced and marketed a drug called fluoxetine. Fluoxetine was based upon this theory of insufficient serotonin in the system. And so what it does is it prevents the reuptake. Well, it doesn't actually. Because the body is much more intelligent than the researchers. And actually, they've now found out that the body has ways of thinking, oh, there's not enough serotonin in here, so it has ways of dealing with that. It has a homeostatic system, as it's called. It monitors what's going on, and if things are going badly, it readjusts. What fluoxetine does in these SSRIs is they simply gung up the system. There is no evidence that the theory they're based on has anything to do with depression. And endless research and studies since on trials on people with serotonin have shown that it doesn't actually work to cure depression much at all either. There are some studies out there which give positive results, but the vast majority of them give kind of neutral results, and about a third of them give very, very bad results whatsoever. And those results have never been published. That's what they do. This is another one of the ways in which the system is fiddled. Those results that get bad, show your drug in a bad light, just don't publish them. Or you publish them in some very, very minor journal where nobody's ever going to read them. So that's a common practice. Now, you might think, well, you know, this is a drug, not many people have heard of fluoxetine. Well, actually, yes, you have. You have all heard of fluoxetine because it has another name. And the other name of fluoxetine is Prozac. Okay. Prozac, no evidence that Prozac works. It's a multi-billion dollar drug and has been. And Eli Lilly know it doesn't work. So the problem with Prozac, of course, is that like any drug, it also has side effects. So Eli Lilly therefore put in a lot more money and they came up with Zyprexa. And Zyprexa manages to one of the things that serotonin does, it produces in some people a manic state. So Eli Lilly now produce Zyprexa to calm down that manic state. This is what their drug reps are told to tell doctors and other healthcare professionals. Zyprexa is a great mood stabilizer, especially for patients whose symptoms were aggravated by an SSRI. Now, in 1987, Eli Lilly's pharmaceutical division generated $2.3 billion in revenue. In 1992, Prozac became the company's first billion-dollar drug. In 1998, Zyprexa also became a billion-dollar drug. And in 2000, together they accounted for nearly half of the company's 10.8 billion revenues. Two drugs which actually have no purpose and value whatsoever. For the last 20 years, and we can look at this in even wider, chemical imbalance theory of mental health issues goes even wider than that. Like, for example, there was another guy, a Dutch-American guy, who looked into schizophrenia, and he decided that in fact it was an excess of dopamine in the system, another neurotransmitter. No significant evidence. In the last 20 years, there have been an endless series of research papers that have come out that have actually come to the conclusion that people who are not treated pharmaceutically with mental health problems, their long-term prognosis is better than those who are. Now, just to be fair, some people do well on these drugs. They seem to just gunge up the system and they make their life tolerable. They could not have survived possibly without it. They might have committed suicide. So there is some value to them. But in general, the prognosis, if you're on medication for psychiatric illnesses, is not as good as if you're not. If you can survive without them and get through it, then your chances, you would stand a better chance of leading a decent life afterwards. There's almost no reports of this in the media, and we'll come to that in a minute. The drug industry is incidentally the biggest lobbyist in the world, the biggest political lobbyist. It ensures that legislation that damages its interests is squashed. I can't prove there's a connection, but there is actually something really quite interesting going on at the moment. A certain Mr. Cameron, who you may know of, some while back said that he was going to make sure that drug testing, that the granting of licenses to produce drugs will be more thorough in this country in future. Kind of sensible, sort of practical, in terms of human rationality, a kind of a practical solution. Suddenly there's a rash of drug companies, Novartis and Roche in particular in this country, Swiss companies, are saying, we're going to close down our centres here, our manufacturing units here. Suddenly there's a change of heart by the government. Now, I don't know that they're connected, but I mean, it just seems very suspicious to me. Mike O'Brien, the health minister, is recently quoted as saying he was seeking to make the UK a more favourable environment for pharmaceutical companies. And the government has stressed its determination to do what it takes to make the UK a location of choice in Europe for biopharmaceutical industry activity. Interesting. What Cameron is actually saying is that, oh God, you know, our licensing process is gunged up with bureaucracy. It's a complete change around. It's all gunged up with bureaucracy. What we want to do now, I mean, you may have seen this in the press, what we want to do now is to streamline this so that these drugs are available much more quickly for those people who need them. Yeah? Suddenly there's a change around. Yeah? Now, I can't prove a connection, but it sounds very likely to me that the big drug companies have got in and have kind of started twisting a few arms there. They're very powerful lobbyists. In fact, The Guardian recently reported that Suparna Saxena, who is head of global marketing at Novartis, warned that Novartis could move some of its drug safety trials out of Britain because of the slowness of the NHS system is making them uncompetitive.